If you would open up to Genesis 45, just want to spend a little bit more time on these last few verses. As we continue the study of Genesis, we've kind of been making this trek to get Joseph met up together with his father, Jacob. So if you notice, finally, Joseph has revealed himself to his brothers. Now they know who he is. They are certainly stunned when Joseph reveals himself. And then now, as Joseph, even by Pharaoh's proclamation, is going to send these brothers back home to get Jacob and bring him to Egypt, verse 24 says, so he, talking about Joseph, sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, do not quarrel on the journey. Joseph knows the things that they've been through, and he says, don't even fight about it. I'm here. God sent me here. You may have thought you sold me off, but that was just for God to get me here. And I want you to think about what Joseph has been through already in his time, his 22 years in Egypt, starting off as being sold off as a captive, coming into Potiphar's house as a slave. Then, because of the events that happened with Potiphar's wife and these false charges, he gets thrown into prison. And then, after he foretells the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker, they forget about him, or the cupbearer forgets about him, for a few years. And then finally, whenever Pharaoh has this dream, then Joseph is remembered. All that time to realize Joseph goes from being a slave to being a prisoner to all of a sudden being elevated to number two in Egypt. I want you to notice that God never put him in a place where he had an option to go back to Canaan. And he kept him there for a very specific purpose. He knew that he was going to deliver his own promises in terms of what he said to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob about giving the land, providing for them, taking care of them. The descendants would grow as many as the stars of the heavens. And he uses Joseph and keeps him in place, because Joseph never even makes an attempt to go back to Canaan. And now that his brothers have come to him, he's unveiled himself to them, and now sending them back to get their father, he tells them, do not quarrel on the journey. The Lord's taken care of everything. There's no use in fighting about whose fault this is, or trying to find somebody to blame, or trying to relieve your guilt. He says, he doesn't hold any of them accountable for that. Then verse 25, then they went up from Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob. They told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and indeed he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. But he was stunned, for he did not believe them. As you can imagine, they've kept up this story about Joseph being dead for 22 years. And all of a sudden now, they're coming back saying, Joseph's a ruler in Egypt. And so for them, this story, Jacob doesn't believe at the very beginning. And he's stunned even in the thought that they would even say something like this. Almost as if they'd say, this is a terrible joke, boys. Then, verse 27, when they told him all the words of Joseph that he had spoken to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. Those gifts and those portions of things that Joseph sent back with his brothers, specifically the wagons, they must have been some kind of wagons, to look at that and go, I know my boys couldn't afford to buy those. And to see everything taken care of, to go, only the one who's the ruler over Egypt would be able to do this. And so it's whenever he sees these things that all of a sudden you see the spirit of Jacob revived. Now, remember, how old is Jacob at this point? He's 130 years old. And to think about someone at the age of 130 to be slowly diminishing, and then to get this kind of news that it brought about a spirit within him. And if you notice what it causes him to think, verse 28, Then Israel said, it is enough. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. Now, what does that tell you about how Jacob sees himself and his own health and lifespan? He feels like death is drawing near. Like, I'll have enough strength to get down to Egypt, and I'll see my favorite son, my beloved son, and then I'll die. What's something is, in chapter 47, I'll go ahead and give it away, Jacob's not going to die until he's 147 years old. He's got 17 more years that he'll spend with Joseph in Egypt, which tells you, how often do our assumptions, are they wrong? Now, so here he is, and he's thinking, all right, the wagons are here, everything can be taken, the portions will get there, and I've got enough vigor and reviving in spirit just of hearing this news that I'll get there, I'll see my son, and then they can plant me. I'll be done. Not realizing, no, you're going to enjoy this time in Egypt for 17 years before you die. And then they're going to bring him back, of course, to Canaan to bury him later on. But notice how chapter 46 opens up. So Israel set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. So here they are going down from where they were. They come down to Beersheba, which, remember, Beersheba's in the southern part of Canaan land. And so we've got some stories from the past about Beersheba, about some of the herdsmen fighting over these wells, these seven wells. And going, there's a lot of history in this place. And Beersheba is where Jacob was traveling from before. If you remember when he was going up to Bethel, the house of God, where he saw some things. But Beersheba is just the place where that story starts. And so here it is. He comes down to Beersheba, and notice what he wants to do. He wants to make sacrifices. Now, they've gone to all this effort to gather up all these flocks and all these herds, to travel with the wagons, to head down to Egypt, and they get to Beersheba, and apparently it just hits him. I just want to thank God and to stop and make sacrifices here at Beersheba. And God certainly pays attention, because notice the very next aspect of these things in verse 2. God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, here I am. Now here he is. He's made these sacrifices. And it doesn't tell you whether they're burnt offerings or peace offerings or anything along those lines. But he offers these offerings to God, and now God is going to speak to Jacob. Calls him by name twice. And Jacob's response, here I am. I'm listening. Can you imagine being responsive in a vision or a dream of the night? To where, here's an interaction. Verse 3. God said, I am God. I am the Elohim of your father. It's interesting how God speaks about himself in these visions. He says, I am the Elohim of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will close your eyes. Now, you think about the way he talks about himself whenever he's leaving Canaan to go down to Egypt, thinking, I think I can get there before I die. And maybe some hesitancy on his part. And now God sends him this dream, this vision. And notice the things that he unveils to him in the midst of these things. To think about in verse 3, look, this is the Elohim of your father. That's who's talking to you. The one who's kept these promises over and over and over again. The same God that's making you these promises now. He says, don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. Don't even have any fear. Then he says, I will make you a great nation there. And we're going to see a little bit of this here shortly about how great of a nation he's really going to make him over these next 400 to 450 years. He says, most importantly, I will go down with you to Egypt. How important is it that God is with you? We've seen this in the life of Joseph. We've seen this in the life of Jacob, in his dealings up in Paddan Aram, the ultimate upgrade is what Paddan Aram means. And to go, and he went across, if you remember, he went across with a staff, and he came back with a herd and with family, and a lot of it. And he knew that God's the one who had granted these things, the very way that he had promised he would. And so now you see God talking to Jacob, and really on Jacob's own level, going, I haven't left you. I'm not going to leave you just because you go down to Egypt. Now, he says, and Joseph will close your eyes. What do you hear in that? He'll be there when you die. And if you've ever been there when someone passes away, all of a sudden, usually when they pass away, their eyes are open. Someone has to come along and actually close the eyelids. He says, Joseph's going to be there when you die, and he's going to close your eyes. You don't have to wonder whether you're going to make it or not. Here's God, the Elohim, giving Jacob a promise. Here is the way it's going to happen. Do you think that would bring Jacob any peace? Of going, I am going to get to see my son. And you think about how many parents long to be able to see their children, even in difficult times. And so here he lays it out. He says, Joseph says, and I will also surely bring you up again. Now, he's going to bring him up, and he's going to be dead at that point, because Jacob's not coming back to Canaan alive. He says, Joseph will close your eyes, verse 5. And remember, that's 17 years away before that's going to take place. But I'm sure in Jacob's mind, he's not thinking that. Then verse 5. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones. And you're going to read about this in a little bit. There are some grandchildren of Jacob that are along for this trip, actually all of them, who are alive at this point, except for, there's a little exception, their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. So how is Jacob traveling? He's being carried along in a wagon that his son that he hadn't seen in 22 years provided. And now God's saying, and he's going to be there to close your eyes. Verse 6, they took their livestock and their property which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him. Now, think about how big of a caravan this is. All the livestock, all their property. Now, keep in mind, they're nomads, so we're talking about tents and possessions. But going, can you imagine? And he's about to describe a group of 66 people. I don't know about you. Sometimes traveling with just a family of four or six is enough. You think about traveling with 66 and not only just traveling, but taking everything you own. Good thing there's some wagons. Now, here's this group, all this family, Jacob, all his descendants are with him. So all the family that was in Canaan is part of this group. And they're taking care of Jacob. Their wives are all there. Even to the point, look at verse 7, his sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now, I want you to notice something. It talks about his sons, his grandsons, his daughters, plural. We know about Dinah, but remember, we've already looked at some passages about there being other daughters that aren't mentioned by name, and going, humongous group. He says, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. This humongous group of people. And then all of a sudden, from verses 8 all the way down through verse 27, he's going to call by name not only his 12 sons and four wives, of course, Rachel's already passed away, and their sons, and then you start looking at this whole group together. And I first started looking at this and thinking, do we really want to read through all these names of the genealogy as we go down through? And the answer is yes. Yes, we do. And so in going through them, there's a major point that's going on through all this, but I'm going to pose the question to you. Why in the Genesis account would it want to take the time to tell you about all these 11 sons that you already know about and to tell you about their sons, the next generation, to go Jacob, 11 sons, and all their sons? Why take the time to tell you all this information? What's the payoff? What's the benefit? All right, you can read a lot of the names over in the Chronicles. It'll give you some of them. Richard? And he's not leaving anyone out of it. Like, here's what's laid out. Eric? Right. What's going to be the 12 tribes of Israel in the promised land? Establishing this nation of Israel as a whole. Now, you think of all those ideas, and there's several good ones. When is the book of Genesis written? Moses writes it in the wilderness. Can you imagine being in the wilderness and hearing the book of Genesis and going, that's my relatives. I'm of that tribe. I'm in this story. Anybody in here like studying through their ancestry? Some people might not. But if you're a Jew, you do. And you start to see this broader picture and going, this is what God has done. In the 450 years or so from this point until the children of Israel are delivered out of Egypt, this is where God started with this group. And look at what we have now. Now, let me just give you a general idea about that group whenever they come out of Egypt. We know from the census that comes later on in the book of Numbers that there is a little more than 600,000 men of Israel from the age of 20 to the age of 55. 605, 608,000. That's just the men. If you were to take the same age block for the women, what would you expect that number to be? Some of you are saying, I think it'd be probably even more. It might be. But thinking, even if it's just the same, how many people are you dealing with? 1.2 million people, but we're only counting the people between the age of 20 and 55. I think there's anybody of any other age in Israel? So what if you start to imagine you take all these other demographics, being younger than 20, being older than 55, even if you were really conservative and came up with like 800,000, now what size group are you dealing with? 2 million. Wouldn't it be interesting? I mean, you think about congregations of the Lord's body that get planted to different places, and they might start off with just one or two families and maybe have 5 or 7 or 10 people. And then to look 100 years later and to look at what the Lord's done in an area and to go, and now there's a place that has 300 Christians. Do you think you'd want to know more about those people where it started? I think you might be curious to go, here they are. And I want you to think as we read down through these things of other routes that we're talking about where they're going later from what we know further on in Scripture. Notice verse 8. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt. Reuben, Jacob's firstborn. Here we go, verse 9. The sons of Reuben, Hanok and Palu and Hezron and Carmi. The sons of Simeon, Jemuel and Jamin and Ohad and Jachin and Zohar and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman, which tells you Simeon married a Canaanite woman, and she's on this trip too, but we're not counting the women just yet. Then, verse 11, the sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Now, why would that be important to write in? All right, this is where the priests are going to come from. Who's writing the book of Genesis? Moses. Who's he a descendant of? Levi. Specifically through Kohath. Wouldn't it be something to be writing a book and get to write about your relatives, making sure they get included? Now, of course, it's inspired, so it's not like Moses going out on his own trek here. But to write these things down and to go, here is, and think about how short this is. Levi's has a son by the name of Kohath. Kohath has a son by the name of Amram, and Amram has a son, two sons, by the name of Aaron and Moses. He also has a daughter by the name of Miriam. But to go, look at what's being talked about here. Can you imagine? Here's Moses being inspired by the Spirit of God to write the book of Genesis and to start to come down through these things, and he gets to write that down. Wouldn't that be something? Then, verse 12. The sons of Judah, and you may be thinking back to what we've already looked at in Genesis 38 with the story with Tamar and these men. He says, the sons of Judah, Ur and Onan and Shelah and Perez and Zerah. But Ur and Onan died in the land of Canaan because they were evil. We've already read that. He says, and the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. Now, if you think about the sons of Perez, it's interesting. It doesn't even mention Tamar at this point because you already know about it. But here's kind of another picture with what's coming later. And think about it, they're only about 40 years away from these events. Judah, of course, through Tamar, has the twins of Perez. But here it mentions the sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. Now, the descendants of Jesus are going to come through Hezron. Hezron's going to have a son by the name of Ram. Ram's going to have a son by the name of Abinadab. And Abinadab's going to have a son by the name of Nashon. You're going, I don't care about these names. What does that mean to me? Nashon's going to have a son named Salmon. That name may be a little more familiar. Salmon is going to marry a prostitute in the city of Jericho, but only after she's shown herself to be a woman of faith. And that woman's name is Rahab. Salmon and Rahab are going to have a son by the name of Boaz. Boaz is going to marry a Moabite woman by the name of Ruth. They together are going to have a son named Obed. Obed's going to give birth to Jesse, and Jesse's going to have a son by the name of David. David's going to later on have a descendant by the name of Jesus Christ. I know, I flashed forward a ways on you. But to realize, and to understand this too, notice how Levi and Judas and Judah are mentioned one after the other. Do you realize that Jesus has some priestly relatives? Have you thought about that? If you remember, whenever Mary is pregnant, she goes to visit her relative by the name of Elizabeth. And of course, Elizabeth's wife is a priest by the name of Zechariah. And they're going to give birth to a son by the name of, we're going to name him John because I want to talk again. Now, John the Baptist. And you realize, here's Jesus tied in with this priestly group, and we could go way more into that if we were in Matthew chapter 1, but I'll spare you that. Shealtiel is the name you want to remember in that. But here we go, and you see, these are the things, these are the roots of what he's going back to go, don't forget where these things go. Then, verse 13, the sons of Issachar, Tola, and Puva, and Eob, and Shimron, verse 14, the sons of Zebulun, Sered, and Elon, and Jehiel. Verse 15, These are the sons of Leah, which is telling you about these previous six sons. He says, whom she bore to Jacob in Paddan Aram, the ultimate upgrade up there in the northern country, with his daughter Dinah, she gets mentioned. All his sons and his daughters numbered 33. So the Leah clan numbers 33. Then we move on to another here, verse 16. The sons of Gad, Ziphion and Haggai, Shumai, and Esbon, Eri, and Arad, and Arali. You go, that's a lot of sons. We're starting to build them up. Verse 17. The sons of Asher, Emma, and Ishva, and Ishvi, and Beriah, and their sister, Sarah. And the sons of Beriah, Heber, and Malchiel. So you realize, now we're really getting down into some generations. Like, oh boy, these are getting down to some, not just some grandsons, but really getting beyond even into great-grandsons. So here's this picture, and you may be thinking, do you remember anybody in the New Testament who's of the tribe of Asher? It's kind of obscure. Whenever Jesus is born, and on the eighth day he's circumcised, and on the 33rd day they go to offer up a sacrifice, they bring, Mary and Joseph bring Jesus into the temple to make this offering. And there's a prophetess by the name of Anna, and she is of the tribe of Asher. And she proclaims, she pronounces, it's like they come in with what they perceive to be a big secret. And Simeon, who's an old man, had been told, you won't die until you see the Lord's Messiah. He sees him, he says, I'm released to die. And then all of a sudden, Anna shows up, and she takes him, and she's like, oh, here he is. I've heard all about him. And nothing like having what you think is a family secret, have everybody talk about it. And you go, I guess it's not that quiet anymore. And so here she is. And to think her lineage goes all the way back to Asher. And it makes that specific point if you look at it over in Luke chapter 2, verse 36. So you see these things starting to come together. Then verse 18, these are the sons of Zilpha, whom Laban gave to his daughter Leah, and she bore to Jacob these 16 persons. So we got 33, we got 16, we're up to 39, things are looking kind of big. Verse 19, the sons of Jacob's wife Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin, who could forget them? Now to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim. Remember, Manasseh is about God made me to forget the past, but he still certainly remembers. And Ephraim about look at the way God has blessed me, whom Asenath, his wife, the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of Onan, bore to him. And so here they are, verse 21. And Benjamin, man, does he have sons. Whew. The sons of Benjamin, Bela and Besher and Ashbel, Gera and Naaman. This is not Naaman the Syrian, the story in the book of Kings, so don't make that tie. Eli and Rosh and then Mupim and Hupim. Boy, doesn't that sound like fun names. And Ard, what a name too. These are the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob. There were 14 persons in all. So now we're 39 plus 14. We're getting to 53. So you're getting up to some higher numbers. And then it switches it back, and you're going to come down to the last handmaid of Bilhah. Verse 20. Well, before we go any further, why is Benjamin so important in the Old Testament? Who's going to come from Benjamin? Saul is. King Saul. And to go, here he's going to be the first earthly king of Israel. And you look at these pictures. In the New Testament, who comes through Benjamin? Same answer. Saul. But he's going to change his name, of course, to Paul. And if you read over in Philippians chapter 3, verse 5, you see where that comes in, and he's very specific about, I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. So what would it be like for Paul to read through the book of Genesis and learn about Benjamin and how Benjamin was treated and to see what God had prepared for Benjamin and to see what God had prepared for him? Now, you think of these things together and to go, you can understand why these things get mentioned the way they do. Then, verse 23, the sons of Dan, Hushim. That's it. Verse 24, the sons of Naphtali, Jaziel and Guni, what a name, and Jezer and Shillem. These are the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to his daughter Rachel, and she bore these to Jacob. There were seven persons in all. So you start adding up, 33, 16, 14, 7, and you're going to come up with the number in verse 26. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all. So specific. Doesn't that seem to be interesting? He says, I want you to know 66 is the number when you don't count the wives. Then he adds in verse 27, and the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were two. All the, of course, we already know them by the name of Manasseh and Ephraim. He says, all the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. 70 is this group name, or group number. I want you to notice how many times this number shows up. Just turn with me real quickly. Look over at Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1. It's about 400 to 450 years later. Exodus chapter 1, verse 1. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household, which we just read about. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number. But Joseph was already in Egypt. So he tells you, there's 70 of them. You think, okay, this seems obvious. You go, why? Why bring this up? Look over at Deuteronomy chapter 10. Just want one verse. Deuteronomy chapter 10. Look down at verse 22. And notice what this is all tied to. Somebody else already brought this up tonight, but make sure you see it. Your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons in all. And now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. Isn't that what God promised? Isn't that what he promised Abram? He says, you want to know how many, you're saying you don't have a descendant that's a blood descendant of yours, but the next in line is Elimelech, who's of Damascus, and he's going to be the one who's your heir because you don't have any children, and here you are at this age, about 75 years old. And he tells him to step outside and take a look up. He says, can you count the stars? He says, that's how many descendants you're going to have. And to think, by the time Deuteronomy chapter 10 is written, it's written as the descendants were 70 whenever they came down to Egypt. They're as numerous as the stars now. And at a conservative, very conservative estimate, 2 million by the time they come out of the wilderness, as well as go into the wilderness. And you start thinking, how is God at keeping his promises? You think about the plans that he had through the tribe of Judah with Jesus, through the tribe of Levi with Moses, through the tribe of Benjamin with Paul. Other people all scattered throughout as well. And to think, here's God keeping his promises time and time and time again, when they look impossible. And to think, that's the God we serve. If you have a promise, then you know the way it's going to turn out. You don't have to guess.
God's also really specific about this history. When people are doubting, people are doubting, you just don't see any other human that has that term. I can prove all this wrong by showing you that so-and-so didn't know.
So-and-so. Right. 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 You see the reproduction of witnesses on multiple stages and being able to see these things come through. Now, notice how this continues on even further. Come back to Genesis 46. And it says, now he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen. And remember, Goshen means drawing near. And Goshen was the fattest and the best of the land. That's what Pharaoh said. Joseph, give your people, give your family the fat and the best of the land. And sure enough, he sends him to Goshen. And Goshen is going to be a very place of protection in the days of Moses. He says, so Judah goes ahead to prepare the way to Goshen, to this place where everything is going to be provided. Can you think of anybody who's gone ahead of us to prepare a place for us? Here's a descendant of Judah by the name of Jesus to prepare a place for us. He says, they came into the land of Goshen, verse 29. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. I mean, this is the moment we've been waiting for. All of a sudden, Joseph gets on his own chariot. He goes out to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. Now, we've read it in the past, where Joseph fell upon the neck of Benjamin, and boy, they cried a while together. Even upon the necks of his brothers, Joseph cried about it. And now, for him to finally see his father, and to think, the last time that Joseph and Jacob had seen each other, Jacob was telling him, go up to the land and check on your brothers and see how things are going. And Joseph followed his father's orders to a T, even going the extra mile to go to Dothan. And he hadn't seen him since and thought he had been killed. And now to get to see him face to face. I don't know what you think of whenever you hear a long time, whether you think 30 seconds, 30 minutes, or an hour. But man, there weren't a whole lot of words to start. But there sure were a lot of tears. And they were happy tears. I have a hard time picturing someone who's 130 years old crying their eyes out. Jacob and Joseph are having that moment. And here they are. Imagine coming to see your son, who's number two in the empire of Egypt. You may think of this story, and maybe somebody's thinking about Luke chapter 15, about the prodigal son whenever he comes home, and he falls on the neck of his father, and they cry. It's not exactly a parallel here. It's not as if Jacob has been the one who's been eagerly looking for his son, who's been wasting his life away. Jacob's been faithful the whole way through. And yet to see this picture and go, it's quite a moment. Verse 30. Then Israel said to Joseph, now let me die. You think about that for just half a moment. Now I can die satisfied. Just for a moment, imagine to see your children. Now I can die. He says, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive. Verse 31, Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, here's 66 of them, 70 if he includes his own. He says, who are in the land of Canaan have come to me. He says, excuse me, I skipped a line. He says, I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, my brothers and my father's household who are in the land of Canaan have come to me, and the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. When Pharaoh calls you and says, what is your occupation? Let me tell you the answer you should say, because it'll be honest and it'll be true. So say it. Verse 34, you shall say, your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth, even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians. He says, you go in and just tell them your shepherds, they won't want to have anything to do with you. They'll be like, Goshen sounds good to us. You go right ahead. But here's the aspect of this I want you to see. Pharaoh is willing. And remember what it said earlier about with Joseph and Pharaoh's relationship. He says, Joseph says, I'm like a father to Pharaoh in how that he sees me. And now to go, here they are. He says, let me give you the answers that are honest and you say them and things are going to turn out well for us because we're going to be put in the best land and the fat of the land. And remember, what's going on during all these events? The ugliest famine they had ever seen. And they're only 2 years into it, and they have 5 years left. To be brought in as foreigners and to be put in the very choice prime spot in the midst of a famine, has God provided for his people? Is he going to keep his promises? He certainly will. Now, I want you to turn over to Matthew chapter 22. And I want you to think about this parallel. Hopefully we can squeeze it in a few minutes. Matthew chapter 22, look at verse 31. Jesus, in the middle of a ridiculous question, shares this truth with the Sadducees who've come to him to ask. I want you to think about Jacob's position, and his son has been with the king. And he's been with him for at least 9 years now, been taken care of. But he really didn't understand that. But I want you to notice the God we serve. Verse 31, but regarding the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was spoken to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Now, they were talking about when someone raises from the dead, who are they going to be married to? And Jesus is like, you're not going to be married to anybody else. He says, God's people are married to Christ. But the idea here, he's saying, look, God is not the God of the dead. He's the God of the living. And whenever these verses are quoted out of Exodus, they really come together with this idea of who's still alive with God. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all those men and women of faith, and going, they're safe with God. They're not dead. They're not gone. Now, look over at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Look at verse 13 and 14. Paul and Silas and Timothy, as they write to the saints at Thessalonica, have these words. But we do not want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who are asleep, dead, physically dead, so that you will not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. He says, you don't have to grieve like they do. Verse 14. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. I want you to think about a parallel. The way Jacob thought about Joseph, he thought he was what? He thought he was dead. But instead, who was he with the last 9 years? He was with the king of Egypt. And whenever Jacob sees Joseph and sees what the king has done with him, is Jacob pleased? Is he excited to see him? That it moves him to tears. Do you ever think about those in Christ who have already died? And sometimes we're kind of like Jacob. We think we'll never see him again. We'll never see him again. And what do we forget to remember? They're with the king. They're with the king. And to think, if we stay faithful to Christ, who will we see again? We'll see them. Now, you notice it here. I know the bell rang, but skip down to chapter 5 and look at verses 9, 10, and 11. He says, he makes it even more straightforward. For God has not destined us for wrath, but for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we will live together with him. Whether alive on earth or asleep, whether we've died. God is the God of the living. And who will we be together with, whether we're here to serve him or whether we are asleep? We're going to be with King Jesus. And to think, someday, we're going to see those who died in faith and to be together with him. I don't know if our reaction is going to be the same as what Jacob and Joseph had. I can't tell you that part. But I want you to understand, those who have died in faith are with the Lord. And to understand, are we going to walk by faith together with the Lord too? Because there's only good that lies ahead.